It's the Goodbye Gandolfini edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Dolphin Wu, anti-science lefties, spinning statues, and the day McCartney died. Let's begin episode 216.
Welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. So, Tony Soprano is dead. I've been actually kind of surprised at how much of a bang that is made in the world stage. I mean, everyone everywhere is mourning the death. And I mean, granted, he's a great actor and it was a great show. But Ethan, did The Sopranos like touch you? Have you?
Oh, I mean, I got into The Sopranos after close to the show's end, and I bought the DVD sets. I remember quite clearly how I was scanning Amazon.com for deals, and I eventually found them on sale, and I scooped them up, brought them home, and I think I must have gone through them in the course of like maybe a week or two. But I mean, the thing with The Sopranos, and I mean, James Gandolfini himself, he wasn't exactly in a lot of shows. He had bit roles in movies. Of course, The Sopranos is what we all remember him for. But I mean, the fact that it was such a well-written show, it's widely considered one of the greatest TV shows of all time. And of course, the reason it is because of his character. I mean, here was a guy, one of the real first anti-heroes I can think of on TV. I mean, a guy who was basically a despicable human being, and yet we rooted for the criminal.
Okay.
I mean, we have like things like Breaking Bad and Game of Thrones and all these horrible people who were like, yeah, kill that guy.
Yeah, no, actually, I guess you're right, because I was sitting there saying, there have been a lot of anti-heroes before, and I was smiling at Ethan when he said that. But you're right, most of those anti-heroes would be something like Clint Eastwood in, oh God, I can't remember the movie, where he's a good person. Who has very he's a good guy, like he's the cop, right?
Right.
But he has a very bad personality to him, right? Whereas this was just like you say, he was the criminal, he was the bad one. I think one of the things that I liked most about The Sopranos, in particular, and again, I think this is where it made a lurch, was the fact that in the end, the thesis of the story is that some people just are broken and they're not going to be fixed. And that some people, even in their best intentions, are just enabling.
Yeah, that was one of the themes of the show. It seemed to be sort of that no matter what happened, these people weren't going to get better. They were just going to keep getting worse. And I think that was an interesting move. I think audiences want to see characters go from being bad to good guys. We like that story. Sopranos didn't have that story.
Well, even like in the final episode where essentially, I forget her name, the psychiatrist who was treating...
Dr. Melfi, I think?
Yes, who basically said, no, I'm not going to see you anymore. You're a lost cause. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think when that happened, that was like when they killed off the next person in Game of Thrones. Insert everybody there.
Yeah.
but I mean, I think that shocked a lot. Because I mean, the final episode, you figure, well, maybe he's going to get killed. And that was rather ambiguous. But that, there's going to be maybe this big breakthrough. And he turns his life around and he becomes a good guy or something. But no, it was just very stark.
It was. Well, why don't we shift gears here on Radio Free Thinker and switch to Dolphins and Woo. Which is quite a jump, I understand, but nevertheless, something really interesting.
Well, I'm sure you can train the dolphins, to jump through anything. And I thought they were in water, but what are they in Woo for?
So I came across this while doing my daily internet surfing, and it turns out that dolphins are being used as healers actual healers, faith healers. There's a cottage industry of using swimming with dolphins as sort of like a spiritual medical treatment. And typically it's usually people who have either sick or maybe disabled children. Parents will come in, have their kids swim with dolphins. And I mean, dolphins, because they're viewed to be sort of intelligent, altruistic, gentle, happy, the idea is that they're going to transfer these, you know, happy traits to children, and this will translate into healing and well-being.
Well, I thought one of the other more less woo aspects of it is that because dolphins do seem to be so human and they're so not in a normal daily life, that meeting something that is so different yet in some ways supposed to be so similar to you has sort of that awe effect on the person. So it's not like the dolphins are magic in themselves, but it's the fact that they so widen someone's perspective of what's possible in the world that that can be used as inspirational.
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes from the fact that it's like what we've talked about before with any kind of bogus treatment, is that after your immediate use, there is, you feel this sort of spike of it's working. And then that will slowly decrease over time. I found a quote from the article about this story that I thought was kind of interesting, and I want to read it to you. Quote, "While we're not promising to cure, DAT facilities, that's dolphin treatment facilities, market themselves as offering real therapy as opposed to recreation. Under minimal standards, authentic therapy must have some relationship to a specific condition and result in measurable remedial effects. By contrast, DAT proponents cite evidence that is more accurately anecdotal, offering a range of explanations for its purported efficiency, from increased concentration to brainwave changes to the positive psychological effects of echolocation, high-frequency dolphin sonar on the human body. Parents of autistic children and others who appear to benefit from DAT believe that these explanations are scientifically plausible. The photos of smiling children and the emotional testimonies from once-depressed parents are hard to resist. Even those skeptical of DAT's scientific validity often just shrug and say, 'What's the harm?'" Very familiar, of course.
Yeah. Well, what is the harm?
Well, in doing my research, it turns out there's actually quite a bit. For humans, like many of the pseudosciences that we've covered on the show, the harm comes from wasted time and money. These treatments with dolphins are extremely expensive. Desperate people are often bamboozled into thinking that this is going to act like some sort of cure-all, and it doesn't. And they're left with this sort of unpleasant realization that they were either scammed or they didn't follow the treatment properly. So they either blame themselves or they sort of rationalize it and assume that it just didn't work for them.
Well, and isn't there also the I mean, these are wild animals, right?
Of course,
and I mean,
yeah.
As a wild animal, it's, you know, it's mostly good with humans, from what I understand. But again, that's pretty anecdotal on my part. But I mean, you know, they have teeth. They have been known to use their bodies as battering rams in defense. So, I mean, there strikes me as a lot of, like, physical risk to this, especially when they had something I read once about dolphins being used for birthing, that somehow having a dolphin in the pool with you was somehow good. And I'm going, isn't that kind of like putting red meat in front of a tiger? I mean,
yeah, well, that's one of the other big harms. Apparently, dolphins aren't exactly happy to be around humans all the time. There's lots of instances of dolphins biting people or nearly drowning them, like breaking arms and legs. And in fact, there's also a lot of harm for the dolphin itself. Now, I mean, there's problems associated with captivity in any sense. So you need careful medical supervision to treat. Dolphins, for example, when they're in captivity, they get very stressed out. And this causes immune system problems. It causes problems with many of them getting really bad, like, I don't know what, I guess what you'd call it, like problems with their skin and their immune system, where they catch infections really easily. And these are all things that require, like, really trained staff to treat it. So that's why, like, an aquarium will have a huge roster of like, veterinarian experts. Whereas these sort of situations don't really have that. They just sort of have feel-good vibrations that don't really help the dolphin and potentially endanger the human being that goes into the water with it.
I wonder what kind of standards they have to uphold for, like, caretaker. You mentioned an aquarium, you know, where they have a veterinarian, they have someone who's professionally trained to deal with dolphins, they have all these facilities. Whether these facilities have to meet up to similar standards.
Well, from what I could undercover, these facilities don't actually have many standards. There's no official regulation of dolphin therapist, so they can really get away with almost anything.
No international society for dolphinology?
Unfortunately, no.
No. I'm probably, it's not dolphinology anyhow. It's probably some cessation word or whatever. It's
possibly, just, yes.
But anyhow, you know, this is an interesting example, I think, of where, you know, you get this sort of lefty sort of holistic mentality coming through. And in odd sort of ways, it goes in with something that I sort of think of the anti-science of the lefties. Now, people know that my views are generally a bit more to the left than the average person, and shame on you for all that. We have here more than once, well, okay, quite often, expunged the right for their anti-science views, be it, you know, climate change denial, creationism, a host of other governmental issues, most notably Harper's current war on science. Well, less often, but just as important, we've called out our own when, quote, one of our side gets it wrong. Notably here, like Islamophobia and atheism, the afeminism of skepticism, and by afeminism here, I mean like atheist, as in people who think skepticism and feminism are like non-overlapping magisteria. Well, I've come across a few articles lately that have reminded me all too often that the left can be just as anti-science as the right when it serves their ideological goals. The first thing I came across was a study about GMO grains that cause inflammation of the bowels. Sounds pretty scary. Kind of makes you want to ban those GMOs or at least have them labeled. The study, a long-term toxicology study of pigs fed a combined genetically modified soy and GM maize diet or corn diet, was published in the Journal of Organic Systems this month. It has the aim, quote, to perform a thorough long-term toxicology study of pigs in the U.S. commercial piggery in order to compare the effects of eating either mixed GM soil or GM corn diet or the equivalent of their non-GM ingredients. So the results of this study, while there was no statistical significant difference in the food intake, food conversion, number or nature of illness, the number of veterinary interventions, the cost of veterinarians or mortality between the two groups, between the non-GM fed and the GM fed pigs, their biochemistry, it was found that there was no significant differences. So far it sounds pretty good for GMO foods. They weighed the organs and found that there was no statistical difference between the two groups except for uterine weight, which is weird, but the authors didn't make much of it, so I'm not going to. They go on to say something like this, quote, we found severe stomach inflammation in 22% of the male pigs fed by the GM diet and 41.7% of the female pigs fed in the GM diet compared to 5.6 and 18.9 respectively in the pigs fed on the non-GM diet. Whoa, wait a minute. Is this right? Stomach inflammations are 2 to 4 times greater with GMO than not? Well, maybe not. First, the study size was only 87 pigs, so not tiny, but still not very large. Ironically enough, the term long-term study here means 22 weeks, but to be fair, that apparently is the actual average lifetime of a slaughtered pig, so enjoy your next pork chop. Of course, then you have to check out other things. Like, so where was it published? Because whenever you look into a study, it's important to get all these other things sort of rounded out so you can interpret the results. And at the Journal of Organic Science, Systems, which is sponsored by the Organic Federation of Australia and the Centre for Sustainability in New Zealand. So, you know, a bit of bias there, but nothing to really condemn them yet. However, the lead author, Judy Carman, has a website devoted to anti-GMO causes. So definitely raises some bells there. It's kind of like the Dr. Shah with the anti-vax movement here. So This is someone who does sort of real science, but they do it with a real ideological bent. But again, I can be kind of biased at times too, but that doesn't mean I can't do good reporting. So let's look a little deeper. So then I looked at the data itself. Actually, when I say I looked at this data, I did metadata review of what other people have reviewed. So, and those 4 times greater risk. Well, it's based on the severe number of... let me take that again. So it's based on severe numbers. And that's 9 pigs had severe... inflammation of the stomach in 9 of the cases for non-GMO versus 23 for GMO. But it's a scale of 1 to 4. So it goes from nil, mild, moderate to severe. So here again, if we looked at it as 2 categories and not 4, so combining nil with mild and moderate with severe, now the numbers are 38 to 41. So statistically insignificant. But What about that? What is severe? How did they judge what qualifies as mild, moderate, or severe? The study could have used some objective measures like biochemical markers, tumors, ulcers, which, by the way, I checked and counted the number of ulcers, 91 for the non-GMO versus 86 for the GMO. Anyway, the criteria for severe was not based upon was actually based upon the appearance of the stomach. So essentially, they used the subjective opinion of how they thought the stomach looked at the time. Now, the biases of the researchers come from a footnote to center stage. Of course, other issues that were raised here is, first, the pigs were fed both GMO corn and GMO soy. So which one is the culprit if we assume there was a culprit? And when you say, yes, so more study is needed, that kind of brings up the other issue here, is that this is really anomaly hunting. It was a fishing expedition, essentially. It's not bad in and of itself, but it's only half the job. Once they sort of perceive this sort of anomaly, what they should have done was completed the study by seeing if either GM corn or GMO soy was causally linked. So somehow making sure the connection between the two wasn't just accidental,
right,
and then coupling that with not a subjective test, but an objective measure of some form. Of course, this study was picked up in the popular press with titles like, "Is Our Food Unhealthy? Study Casts Doubts on the Safety of GM Food." I don't think we heard about it as much here because this is really sort of an Australian-based entity, and there was a bit more pushback here from the skeptical community, which is good. So Ethan, lefties and their whole thing against GMOs and all that. Why?
Well, it's hard to say exactly. I think that if you sort of look at some of the talking points that you encounter in sort of highly politicized communities, one of the things that frequently comes up in the left is things about food, about genetic engineering, about GMO foods. Just like if you were to look at what are frequent talking points on the right, you're going to see things like climate change and gun control. So it's hard to say exactly why that is. I mean, why we have certain obsessions with certain topics, or why we just can't seem to think critically about certain things. That I don't know. But I mean, when you talk about sort of the details of the study and looking at the details and pointing out where there are faults and where they're not following proper scientific procedure and where the bias is showing, you know, it's kind of too bad that that angle of the research wasn't played up as well, because that's kind of important, I think.
Yeah, I think a lot of it too, and this is where the lefties kind of so anti-climate change and all that from the right is usually because they're trying to protect corporate interests, mm-hmm. and if it goes against corporate interests, they go against their ideology. And on the left, you tend to get a more anti-corporate view. So people perceive GM foods to be supporting big agra, right? Organic food, which is another one they have out there, because they somehow think that organic food, even though it's mass marketed, is somehow made by Bob, who has a farm just down the road, even though it's still big corporations. And I think that's where it gets ideologically driven. One, though, that I don't think works in the same way. Well, as I said, there's been a number of issues on the left for anti-science that I read just this week. Another was sort of the pathological hatred for nuclear energy by the Green Movement. See, there was this prize in Germany to promote green technology called the Green Tech Award. The Green Tech Awards are, quote, important environmental prize striving to ecological and economically engagement and the development environmental technology. Now, that sounds a little weird, but it's German translation. So applicants are required to contribute their share to protect the environment and resources towards ecological sustainability and avoid or reduce pollutants. So candidates submitted their proposals in several categories. Within each category, one nominee for the final round was selected by a public online polling. Two more were nominated by a jury. So far, so good, except for the category Galileo Wissenschaft, or to us Anglos, Galileo Knowledge Award. In the online voting, the public chose a nuclear reactor. The popular nominee was a dual or two-fluid reactor. This is a Gen 4 reactor style. It's designed to, it promises to create cheap electricity, produce fuel for cars. I'm not quite sure how that worked out. And even to use and burn and reduce nuclear waste, like plutonium, that's left over from the second generation reactors we currently use, and all with a very, very low carbon footprint. So unlike our current second generation reactor, and that's the one you think of, Three Mile Island and that sort of thing, this style of reactor is low pressure, so there's little chance of leaks because there's no pressurized water going around anywhere, or explosions like you had at Fukushima where pressure built up in a chamber and boom. They're based on thorium, which really can't have a chain reaction, so there's no worry about that. There are fewer parts exposed to radiation, things like to secondary radiation. So you have like the chamber that the nuclear power fuel rods are stored in, that actually becomes radioactive over time. And because this particular unit used a very small amount, there physically was less secondary nuclear waste created. And thorium is cheap and abundant. Actually, currently right now, thorium is a waste product for rare earth element extraction. So, I mean, it's out there and it's just sort of going to waste. Anyway, the reactor got the nod. It even was officially announced on the GreenTech website. That was until someone in power in GreenTech found out and changed the rules. It now states that selections for nominees and winners will ultimately be done independently by a jury of awards GreenTech. So essentially, the judges will get to do it. Screw you people for your thing. And thus, the dual fluid reactor was replaced. There was no official explanation given, but when there was a popular uproar ensued on Facebook, they did post something that essentially said that anything nuclear had huge risks to the environment and to people, and that they always will be. They even posted something that said about 19,000 dead at Fukushima being the end of nuclear energy. Now, of course, for the record, the earthquake / tsunami killed 19,000 people. Nobody died in Fukushima from radiation after the reactor accident, and probably no one will. Well, okay, maybe a few workers a decade or three from now who went into the reactor to affect the containment. But again, green ideology at work, the anti-science found in the left. The irony, because of their sort of dogmatic hatred of nuclear and their counter praise for solar, wind, and et cetera power, none of which, of course, is quite at the stage now to replace fossil fuels. And yes, I know money should be spent to doing research, but it shouldn't actually come from nuclear power, which is a source we have right now to replace fossil fuel. Where it should come from is fossil fuel subsidies. Billions of dollars a year are spent subsidizing Exxon and Shell, and that's where people should be putting their effort. So no nuclear power plants because they kill people or something. But in a report from Forbes magazine, not a lefty magazine, apparently the biggest killer on the planet for power is coal. Per trillion watts produced, coal kills 170,000 people globally. Now, this is directly and indirectly. And coal accounts for about 50% of the world's power production. The worst off are the Chinese, who about 280,000 are killed a year. And the best, according to this report, was the U.S. at only about 15,000. What about the alternatives? Well, oil comes in at 36,000, biofuels at 24,000. And you say, well, what about green sources of power? Let's keep this. And granted, they're a lot better, but still, hydro kills apparently 1,400 people per trilowatt. Solar, 440. Wind, 150. I assume those are from installation accidents more than anything else. But the least deadly of all is nuclear at only 90. So while they prevent nuclear power plants from being built, what is being built are fossil fuel plants that have an orders of magnitude deadlier than nuclear power plants. Ethan, again, I don't get it.
I don't either, Don. I wish I had an answer for you, but I don't. Let's go to a quick break here on Radio Free Thinker. We'll be back with more after this.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
So vote.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlock, Chairman.
This guy standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, the spinning Egyptian statue.
No, you're kidding me.
No, I'm not, unfortunately. This is a new segment that gives us a good opportunity to try out Occam's Razor. So you may have heard of the so-called spinning statue located in the Manchester Museum in Britain. This statue in question is a 4,000-year-old relic from Egypt. It is Neosunmu, originally an offering to Osiris, the god of the dead and ruler of the underworld. And apparently, it's moving on its own.
No.
Yes. So, museum curator Campbell Price wrote in the Manchester Museum's blog a few months ago, quote, "Most Egyptologists are not superstitious people. When I first noticed that one of our Middle Kingdom statuettes had been turned around 180 degrees to face the back of its case in our new Ancient Worlds Gallery, I wondered who had changed the object's position without telling me. The Egyptians themselves would have appreciated the concern to make visible for passerby the text on its back pillar, a prayer for offerings of the deceased. Yet next time I looked into the case, the statue was facing another direction, and a day later had yet another orientation. None of the other objects in the display had moved, the case was locked, and I have the only key."
Aliens?
Well, I think in this case, Don, it's obviously ghosts.
Oh.
Now, the 10-inch tall statuette of Nebsenu, which has been in the museum for the past 80 years, only spins during the day, and the 3,800-year-old artifact doesn't appear to move at night. Actually, I said it was 4,000 years old. Maybe it's 3,800 years old. I don't know. Anyway, so we have a mystery. Science popularizer Brian Cox, who teaches physics at the University of Manchester, suggests that the movement is due to differential friction. See, the two different surfaces, the bottom of the stone statuette and the glass itself, are rubbing against each other as the museum goers create step vibrations. And it's these vibrations that are making the statuette slowly spin. Okay, so we have our question. Why is this statue moving? We have two explanations, a supernatural one and a naturalistic one. Let's apply Occam's Razor. Which of these explanations is more likely? Literally meaning, which of these two explanations do not require us to make more assumptions about the universe?
So that's what Occam Razor is.
Yes. Let's assume the statue is moving by supernatural forces. According to Occam, we now need to account for those supernatural forces. Basically, which ones? Are they ghosts? Are they Egyptian gods? Are they curses? What exactly is making this happen? How does it work? Why this statue and not any others? Of all the Egyptian artifacts in Britain, is this the only cursed one? Now, I mean, all these questions require answers for us to assume this hypothesis. So we need to answer all these other things about the supernatural world for this hypothesis to be correct. Let's consider the naturalistic explanation. The statue is moving because of differential friction. What this means is that the base of the statue isn't perfectly flat. So if there are any vibrations of people walking past or even a big truck driving across the street, it could cause the statue to move slightly. And since this is a well-established scientific fact, we don't really need to assume any additional hypothesis about the universe. Now, additionally, going with this hypothesis allows us to come up with some answers to related questions. So for example, question one, why aren't the other statues moving? Supernatural explanation? The curse is finicky? Natural explanation. Maybe the bases of those statues are flat. Question two, why is the statue only moving during the day? Supernatural explanation. The curse gets off at 6 p.m.? I don't know. Natural explanation. The vibrations are causing people walking past the display, which only happens during the day. Question three, why is the statue moving in a perfect circle? Supernatural explanation. The curse likes magic circles? Naturalistic explanation. If you look at the statue, most of its mass is on the back of the statue. This would explain why it moves in a circle. It's because the weight of the statue on the back is pulling it in a direction. Question four. Why is the statue moving now and not in the 80 years it's been in this museum? Supernatural explanation. It's taken the curse 4,000 years to track down the statue. Natural explanation. It probably has been moving all those years. Only the previous museum creators aren't freaking morons and figured out what was happening and didn't use this as a dumb publicity stunt, jeopardizing their reputation and the reputation of their museum.
Yeah, no, I'm still going to go for the supernatural because I believe there's more to life than what you can see.
Yeah, well, I mean, it does get you in the newspapers.
You know, ironically enough, it would be, I joked about this beforehand, that if this was actually an alien embedded into the statue, because that actually itself takes up less theories than the ghosty one. I mean, aliens could exist.
Yeah,
there's no
aliens,
supernaturalness about that.
Exactly, exactly. Why don't we take another quick break? When we come back, we're going to dive into a really old pre-internet conspiracy theory. Stay tuned.
$1 billion on the ground, all stretched out and uncurled, would extend about four times around the circumference of the world.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the West End at
212 Productions Limited, The Baker and the Chef, Bang on T-shirts, Vistrude Records, Dream Apparel and Articles for People, Dunleavy Snack Bar, The Fall Tattoo, Fortune Sound Club, Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinemathic, Perch, Project Space, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or online at citr.ca.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don, Paul is dead.
No, he's not. I saw him on TV, and he had this horrible, horrible marriage to this one-legged woman, and he had a, well, not quite as horrible, but from a, you know, ideological point of view, maybe not so good, one before that. She was a somewhat hyper-environmentalist and very, you know, vegan and all that. But they love pot, and pot makes you live forever, so I heard.
Okay, well, that solves that problem. We'll okay. Tune in next time on Radio Free.
So, no. I actually remember this when I was growing up, the rumor that Paul is dead and all the various things. But you've discovered this again, Ethan.
Well, I've always been kind of fascinated by this particular conspiracy theory, and I think it's a cool case study of a pre-internet urban legend that apparently spread really fast. So I'll give you guys a bit of information about this. This centers around the idea that Paul McCartney of the Beatles died in 1966 and was replaced by a lookalike, and there are hidden clues in the Beatles' music that points to this. So we'll start with some background. The rumor's exact origin is kind of hard to nail down. A possible beginning might be a separate rumor that Paul McCartney had been killed in a car crash in London after a traffic accident in January of 1967. Now, the rumors were acknowledged. They were rebutted in the February issue of the Beatles book Fanzine. But this car crash story may have had an impact on the Paul is the rumor of 1969. And we'll find out in a little bit. So, Beatles fans, of course, know that in 69, the band had just released Abbey Road. They were in the process of disbanding. And on the 17th of September, 1969, student Tim Harper of Drake University in Iowa published an article in the school newspaper titled, "Is Beatle Paul McCartney Dead?" The article described a rumor that had been circulated on campus that Paul was dead, At that point, the rumor included numerous clues from recent Beatles albums, including the "Turn Me On, Dead Man" message heard when Revolution 9 from the White Album is played backwards. We've heard this story before about songs being played backwards.
Yeah.
So an interesting fact about this is that according to an article on Snopes, Tim Harper claimed to be not the source of the hoax, but was rather only reporting on it. Many of the clues that were later ascribed to this myth were not present in his first article. Harper claims he got much of the information from fellow student D'Artagnan Brown, who claims to have heard it first on the West Coast, repeated by various musicians. The hoax really took off on the 12th of October, 1969, when a caller to a Detroit radio station, WKNR-FM, told disc jockey Russ Gibb about the rumor and its clues. Gibb and the other callers then discussed the rumor on the air for about an hour, and they apparently even improvised new myths and clues on the spot. Listeners to the show recall someone calling up Gibb to report that if you play Revolution 9 backwards, you'd hear the secret message. 2 days after the broadcast, the Michigan Daily published a satirical review of Abbey Road by University of Michigan student Fred Labor, under the headline, "McCartney Dead, New Evidence Brought to Light." Now, it's likely that many of the, quote, clues that Labor was reporting about, albeit sarcastically, were created or inspired by the improvised anomaly hunting undertaken at the radio station 2 days earlier. And I should point out, the radio DJs and Labor, they thought this was a joke. Like, yeah. This was like an early Onion kind of satire, right? So regardless of all that, the article had some, quote, clues to McCartney's death on the Beatles album covers, clues from Abbey Road. And Labor invented many of them, and he was astonished when newspapers across the U.S. picked up the story. So WKRN-FM further fueled the rumor with a special two-hour program on the subject, The Beatle Plot, which aired on the 19th of October, and it's aired many times on the in the years since. In the early morning of the 21st of October, Robbie Young, a disc jockey in New York, discussed the rumor on air for over an hour before being pulled off the air for breaking format. And this was at a time when the signal for that radio station was really wide. So it could be heard in over 38 states and other countries, probably Canada.
Probably.
Yeah. When Labor started getting international press calls about the story, he unwisely decided to play along and assert the story was true. Paul was dead. The clues were real. There was a follow-up article printed in the underground journal Big Fat Magazine, which gives the dates of Russ Gibb's broadcast as the 12th, the date of Fred Labor's tongue-in-cheek response the 14th, and then we also know that the Beatle Plot aired on the 19th, and Robbie Young's segment aired on the 21st. So in a matter of weeks, student newspapers and radio stations had created a worldwide conspiracy theory that Paul McCartney was dead. Could you imagine if someone at the UBC wrote an article and got picked up by like a radio station in Vancouver and it started a worldwide conspiracy theory?
Well, no. First of all, you said, you know, in a matter of weeks. If this was today, it'd be a matter of minutes.
Well, if they had the internet and stuff.
Yes.
So some of the details of the clues invented by Labor, the idea that William Campbell was Paul's lookalike, as well as the statement that a walrus was a Greek symbol for a corpse or derived from or was like a Scandinavian or American Indian sign of death. I looked into that. I could find no reference to a walrus being a sign of a corpse or whatever. But a lot of those myths came from Labor. And these are sort of ones that have become kind of famous. We can talk about things like the song "I Am the Walrus" a bit later about that.
Yes, where Paul does say he is the walrus.
He is the walrus. Let's return to the British version of the car crash, because apparently this rumor was a source of distress to the Beatles themselves, who publicly talked about it at least once in May of 1967 at a press conference, and again in their fanzine book. Now, the origins that Tim Harper and D'Artagnan Brown talked about, the rumors they heard, probably may have come from this car crash story. So it's kind of an interesting full circle story here.
You mean sometimes there's a kernel of real in this fabrication.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, right? Like, say there's a musician working in London. They hear this story. They don't have time to investigate. They fly to California. They repeat it at a party. It gets spread around, right? Pretty straightforward. So that's the story behind the hoax. Now, I didn't really go into any detail debunking any of the claims. I wanted to first give context to the origin and how it spread around before we discussed any of the actual claims themselves. And the thing that, remember, that's interesting about this is that the claims are not real claims. We know they were made up. So it's not like the claims spurred on the hoax. It was, they were invented for the benefit of the hoax. It's kind of a unique change of pace from other conspiracy theories. And you may ask, you know, why didn't McCartney just come out and say, hey, I'm alive during this whole time period? But if you think about it, the Beatles were breaking up. He was sort of sequestered in Scotland considering his, forthcoming solo career. So he probably wasn't really plugged into the news as much and didn't realize people thought he was dead.
Well, I doubt he Googled himself to find out these rumors.
Well, again, yeah. I don't think Paul McCartney Googles himself now, even though that Google is, you know, available.
Okay.
So let's take a look at some of the specific claims because they're kind of fun. So the supposed replacement of Paul, you can see a small scar in his upper lip. Now, the rumor goes that Paul didn't have a scar, and so ergo, he's a doppelganger. Actually, Paul does have a scar. It's from the car accident that he had in London. And there's all kinds of clues in album covers and songs from Sgt. Pepper. The lyrics from Fixing a Hole.
Actually, sorry, just to go back to that car one, just because I found it striking now that I think about it. You're right. So Paul McCartney isn't supposed to have a scar on his lip. And there's no way he could possibly get a scar in the future because you don't get scars in the future. I think it would be much more better if he had a scar and then suddenly it disappeared. You go,
yeah, that would be more suspicious. Yeah.
Sorry. But anyhow.
Yes. So getting back to some of the quotes here from songs from Sgt. Pepper, here are lyrics from Fixing a Hole. Quote, "And it really doesn't matter if I'm wrong, I'm right where I belong. And see the beetle standing there, they disagree, and silly beetle run around." This is, I guess, referencing the fact that William, Paul's replacement, is adjusting to his new role as Paul McCartney. Now, in reality, this is simply misheard lyrics. The actual lyrics aren't beetles run around or silly beetle run around. It's silly people.
With a good British accent.
That's right. I can't do Paul or John, so not going to try. Lyrics from She's Leaving Home. Quote, "Wednesday morning at 5 o'clock as the day begins." This is supposedly the time of Paul's accident, so it's a hidden message.
As opposed to the time when a teenager would try and run away from home when they didn't think anyone would be up to catch them.
Well, Don, don't be silly.
Yeah.
lyrics from Lovely Rita. Quote, "Standing by a parking meter when I caught a glimpse of Rita." And this is a reference to Paul taking his eyes off the road, not being safe. There you go. Lyrics from "Good Morning, Good Morning." Quote: nothing to do to save his life, and you're on your own. You're in the street, and people are running around. It's 5 o'clock, and watching the skirts, you start to flirt. Now you're in gear, which I guess it's a reference to more of Paul not being alive, unable to save his life.
Well, and they did a weird thing, because, I mean, the first one, She's Leaving Home, is 5 a.m., and the second one is 5 p.m. I mean,
well, it's all part of the hidden message, Don.
Oh.
Yeah. Lyrics from A Day in the Life. Quote, "I saw the photograph. He blew his mind out in a car. He didn't notice that the lights had changed. A crowd of people stood and stared. They'd seen his face before. Nobody was really sure if he was from the House of Paul." Now, that is a misheard lyric. The actual lyrics is House of Lords, not House of Paul.
To be fair, before I knew the rumor and I listened to it, it does sound like the House of Paul.
Oh, yeah. Like,
but
some
again,
of these are,
it's...
Yeah. So some of the big ones, some of the real, you think, nail in the coffin of these sort of things. From Magical Mystery Tour, lyrics from Strawberry Fields Forever. Quote, "I buried Paul," which you can hear at the end of the song. Now, in reality, John is singing Cranberry Sauce, but... accent,
yep.
Music, right? Of course, the White Album, Paper Revolution 9 Backwards, you'll hear, "Turn Me On, Dead Man, Turn Me On, Dead Man." Now, this is audio pareidolia. Well, they're all audio pareidolia, but this is, we've talked about this with Stairway to Heaven. When you prime somebody and then play them the song backwards, they'll probably hear it, right? Now, this is interesting. This is cool. From Abbey Road, you picture the album artwork of, you know, the Beatles walking across the street, right? I'm going to tell you everything that's wrong with the album art, okay? The front shows a funeral procession and depicts John as the preacher in white, Ringo as the mourner in black, George as the gravedigger in work clothes, with Paul as the deceased. Paul is in bare feet, he's out of step with the others, his eyes are closed, and he's the only one shown smoking, holding a cigarette in his right hand when he's left-handed.
Oh!
Clever Beatles.
Yes, you wouldn't think that was a prop or something.
Or the fact that they maybe did it like 5 times and he was...
5,000 times.
Yeah. So all four Beatles have denied being involved in the hoax. Of course they would.
Like, yeah, well, that is the one thing about a conspiracy is you don't actually admit that there is a conspiracy if there is a conspiracy.
Yeah. Paul McCartney was directly asked about this in Life magazine in 1969, and this is what he replied with. Perhaps the rumor started because I haven't been much in the press lately. I have done enough press for a lifetime, and I don't have anything to say these days. I am happy to be with my family, and I will work when I work. I was switched on for 10 years, and I never switched off. Now I am switching off whenever I can. I would rather be a little less famous these days. So, I mean, it makes perfect sense, right? Like, this is, you know... And it's funny, too, because we talked about a conspiracy theory poll a couple months ago. And it was about American voters. And 5% of those asked believed that Paul was dead and replaced by lookalike. So it's not a huge number, but I think it's just a really interesting example of how these conspiracy theories work.
Yes. And I mean, it's persistent, too. Because, I mean, here's the other thing. At what point does fake Paul become Paul?
Yeah.
Okay, let's pretend in 1966 they replaced him with someone new. Well, they replaced Pete Best with Ringo Starr. They had Stu Sutcliffe, who died right before that. I mean, they could have said, hey, he's gone. You know, this is our new guy. They were famous enough at the time that they could have got away with that.
Yeah, right? It's like the Michael Jackson thing about him dyeing his skin white. He was already super famous.
Yeah.
Did he need to get more famous? And as you say, like, I mean, if they replace him with somebody, and let's, like, assume that he, you know, sung and wrote songs, he's probably better than Paul.
Yeah, well...
Some of their best work. I mean, Sgt. Pepper, Abbey Road, I mean, come on.
No, I agree. Yeah. I agree. It's bizarre. But, again, it's this... I think where this comes in, interestingly, is the people's urge for anomaly hunting. Because, again, I think part of this played into it. Because once people said, hey, this is an idea... And then you go back and you start listening to the albums and you go, hey, look at that. And the only thing that she's leaving at 5 o'clock could mean that Paul McCartney died at 5. That's the only possible explanation. Anything else must be, you're daft.
Well, and it also speaks to a trend at the time of looking for hidden meanings in popular music, especially. I mean, all of these thoughts about... pop music, rock and roll being the devil's music, and parents are concerned, so they're like, what do these songs mean? I mean, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. I mean, I know there's a separate rumor about that song, but even still, it's pretty well out there.
Well, okay, but now I'm going to flip it around now, and I'm going to defend them a little bit.
Okay.
So that is, I mean, let's take a look at the era, right? I mean, we're talking late 60s, 1970, right? JFK was assassinated, right? And there was a real plot with that, plus... Everyone suspecting that there may have been someone else besides the lone one. There was the tremendous upturn of society with the police turning on its citizens. You know, there's a lot of police abuse. So you can't trust authority. So people who you might normally say, well, hey, he's alive. You go, well, why should I believe you when you've lied to me about the Vietnam War and you've lied to me about this and you lied to me about that? So the idea of not trusting anyone but yourself or, you know, this sort of counterculture part was prevalent. JFK was assassinated around this. I don't think Robert Kennedy was assassinated yet, but it's in that time frame, right?
Yeah, exactly. There was a culture of distrusting authority. So it makes sense that people would be naturally skeptical. And if you look at the origins of this hoax, that they happened on university newspapers, that's, I think, speaks to a different kind of culture than today. Whereas our conspiracy theories, you know, they get their jump on Facebook and on blogs. I think, if anything, we've kind of grown skeptical of university students anyway, so no one really cares what they think in the first place.
What? No, we love university. Everything. That's great, great. We're big supporters of all the university news, and they have the best conspiracy theories of all.
Well, they do. They're pretty good at it.
Although, to be fair, Fox News the other day, was one of the on-air personalities was quoted to say, we've got nothing to say right now, so we'll just make something up.
They're honest, at least. I mean, that's the nice thing.
But I think you're right. I mean, and also I think another thing that plays into this, which we don't have anymore, and I think we're diminished as a society for this, is that there was the belief that they could find the truth. That, okay, someone said, McCartney said, well, we have it within our power. We're empowering ourselves to go out there and find out the truth. Whereas I don't think people have that much anymore. I mean, the skeptic community is trying to correct wrongs. But there's a much more of a hopelessness, I think, in our society than there was.
Well, I think it appeals to the puzzle solver. Like, if you believe that Paul had died and you believe that the Beatles were putting clues in their songs and you were a fan, you probably would have had a great time, you know, maybe smoking a joint and playing I Am the Walrus 5 times and trying to find the hidden message. And I think that to a certain extent, we see this in our current culture with people, you know, obsessively examining YouTube videos and pausing it here going, what's that shadow? What's that mean? And I think that we still do that. It's just that we're misdirecting our skepticism. I think that we could be examining things from a different point of view that would give us more answers.
Well, and I think, too, another difference is notable. And again, probably not completely different because maybe you'll correct me on current culture. But, I mean, this was pop culture.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And now a lot of the conspiracies deal with, you know, the government or corporations or these big omni thing. I can't remember the last time there was something like this in popular culture recently. I mean, there probably is. I'm just not that in tune with it.
Well, I mean, the only thing I can think of that comes close, I mean, I guess in a similar light, is maybe the whole Elvis thing. Or even Michael Jackson, I guess, was kind of...
Yeah, but even that, we're talking decades ago.
Yeah, it's true.
Right, you know. But, so, what do you think, you may not know about this, so Ethan, you can say, hey, I don't know. The new book and conspiracy theory around Flight 800 in the U.S. It's a flight that went down, I don't remember when, I think it's in the 90s. It crashed into the ocean, killed like 200 and some odd people. It's like the second worst air disaster in American history. It was written off as mechanical failure, but now someone's promoting this idea that it was actually done by an errant missile launched from a Navy patrol boat. And the worst of it is I heard, was it from the Skeptical Inquirer or one of the sort of more skeptical, real skeptical groups that said that this is the most believable conspiracy theory he's heard in a long time.
Well, that could mean different things, right? That could be sort of like a backhanded compliment in certain ways. Hmm. I haven't done a lot of research on it. I mean, I've heard, of course, of the story, and I've heard about the conspiracy. Maybe as a future segment, we can dive into that.
Ooh, that would be interesting.
And speaking of future segments, we're actually almost out of time, so we should probably go to our skeptical highlights. Don, do you have any?
Well, I have a few, but I'm going to start out with a low light. So there is a talk, Myths and Misconceptions in Health. It's being held June 26th, 7 p.m. at the John Braithwaite Community Center. The speaker is Holly Forchalk, whose works to eliminate, quote, the underlying causes rather than treating the symptoms of health. This is your typical woo thing. So, you know, she's like, oh, we're bombarded by all sorts of toxins and all that. She has a portable medical facility that can go to your home, and she has access to over 60,000 variables that she can test in the comfort of your home to find out your nature. She's into Reiki. She's all that. Now, that would just be, okay, there's lots of quacks out there, and she's one of them. But what made me feel that this one elevated to, hey, shame on you, is this is actually being sponsored by the Canadian Mental Health Association.
Oh.
And I was just stunned. Now, I think the first cause of this is that she has 2 degrees. She has one, apparently, in psychology, although she doesn't admit to this. She says, I have studied various modalities and things, and she stresses meditation. And then she went on to get her Doctor of Natural Medicine, which is not really a doctorate at all. Mm. She's written 7 books, so she's definitely making a lot of money off this. It's complete woo, and I'm so ashamed that it's associated with any form of real sort of medicine. The next thing I have is a side, not a promotion, but something that could be interesting. C.K. Chesterton and Christopher Hitchens Old Convert versus New Atheist. Dr. Ralph Wood of Baylor University is a professor of theology and literature. He's going to give a talk about the literary acts of the late Christopher Hitchens versus the responses from C.K. Chesterton, and how he thinks that all of Hitchens' criticisms or response were answered by Chesterton. For those who don't know who Chesterton is, he's essentially a Christian apologist from about 80 years ago. Mm. So it's a bit outdated. But I mean, the debate goes on. Not that there's really debate there, wrong or right. The other one I just thought people will be really interested because it's a nerd thing. Anime Evolution, celebrating Japanese animation, manga, gameplay, and everything else, is happening at the UBC Sub Ballroom June 28th to 30th. Tickets are $20 to $50. There's going to be 24-hour video rooms, cosplay, all sorts of fun things going on. So you can check that out.
I've been to a couple of Anime Evolutions. They are a lot of fun. Mm. My skeptical highlight this week is CFI Freethinkers Book Club, Misquoting Jesus. This is happening on Saturday, July 19th at 1 p.m. at the Grinding Gallery Coffee Bar. The book, of course, is Misquoting Jesus, the story behind Who Changed the Bible and Why by Bart Ehrman. So it should be really interesting. You can get the book at the Vancouver Public Library or from Amazon. And again, that's at 1 p.m. on July 13th, which is a Saturday. Hope you can make it.
Yeah, I've actually read that book. I haven't read many, but that's one of them.
Well, this is...
Actually, Ethan, it's one more thing, just because we have 1 or 2 minutes left, and I'm curious about this. I'm doing this on the spot, so okay. I think I have guard. But maybe as a future segment, have you heard that a minor league hockey player is being charged with assault for a fight that occurred on the ice in a game about 6 months ago? The parents at the event said, hey, what the hell's going on? And they went to the hockey association, and they said kids will be kids, right? Both players got charged with fighting. But when you look at the video, obviously one guy is just wailing the hell out of the other one who's just sitting there, and he got a broken nose. And they actually forced the police to press criminal charges. Like they brought this all up. So maybe as a future episode, the role of violence in hockey, especially considering the Stanley Cup's over, so we can sort of take a step back. What do you think of violence in hockey? Is it necessary? Is it something we should save for a segment?
That would be a fascinating discussion to have. I think that we could really dive into that. Of course, you didn't interrupt me as I was saying goodbye, so I've lost my train of thought.
Oh.
Who am I again?
You're Ethan, and I think you're our historian?
Oh, that's right, yes. I am Ethan, your free-thinking historian, and I'm thanking you for listening today.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on, and keep your puck on the ice.